Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Now, Health Matters, presented by SSM Health. Here's your host, KMOX Health Editor, Fred Bottomer.
Hi there, and thanks for joining us. Really do appreciate it. Hope you're having a great weekend. Lots to talk about over the next hour, including a new study about hair dye and breast cancer risk, an increase in serious knee injuries among children, and we'll find out why some people are skipping their needed heart medication. But first, let's start the way we always do with our co-host, Dr. Fred Buchhold. Dr. Buchhold is a SLU care general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Dr. Buchhold, thanks for joining us again.
Thanks for having me.
Flu season is now underway for most of the United States. It's the earliest start in more than 15 years.
Flu season is here, and it's off to an early and unusual start. The southern states are the hardest hit right now, and flu B viruses are dominating. The CDC estimates so far this season there have been as many as 2.5 million flu illnesses, 29,000 hospitalizations, and 2,400 deaths nationwide. 12 states in Puerto Rico are now experiencing high influenza-like illness. While some are concerned that an early start can mean we're in for a tough season, experts say it's too early to make any predictions. Johnny Fernandez, CBS News, New York.
So, Dr. Buchhold, what do we need to know?
Well, if you haven't yet, get your flu shot. I feel like a broken record with that, but please do so. The only thing surprising about flu season is the fact that it still continues to surprise us. I do find it really interesting. It's in the southern states. I could guess that maybe due to that Arctic dip that we had a couple of weeks ago, but that's just pure conjecture. I've really no idea. But it will come, and the winter months are when we anticipate it. I expect I'm going to be covering the hospital service over Christmas. I expect to be pretty busy with it.
I'm hearing that the influenza B virus is a little bit more prevalent at this time of the year. Usually, that comes more toward the end of the flu season.
Well, again, it's nothing here surprises. And so the flu is an interesting virus in the fact that it changes slightly year after year. So I don't know if evolve is the right word, but it's just the way the genetic material of the virus is made, it's kind of designed, or it's a fact that it just changes slightly year in and year out. So we can predict to some degree what these changes are going to be year in and year out, but that doesn't mean it always follows our predictions, and life, like everything, has some randomness to it. So this doesn't surprise at all.
It seems like every time we talk, it's either about the flu or foodborne illnesses. And we've got a new report from the CDC warning of a new E. coli outbreak linked to salad from California.
At least 8 cases of E. coli in 3 states have been linked to Fresh Express Sunflower Crisp Chopped Salad Kits. According to the CDC, people started getting sick between November 5th and 15th in Minnesota, North Dakota, and Wisconsin after eating the salad mix. One of those patients developed kidney failure. But it's unclear if these new cases are connected to a more widespread outbreak from romaine that sickened 102 people in 23 states, all linked back to Salinas, California. The CDC is telling people to avoid all romaine lettuce grown there until further notice.
Okay, so what do we need to know about salad?
Well, so again, these are bacteria that grow in salad that, natural fertilizer, for instance, is made from feces. So, and then there's, unnatural or synthetic fertilizer that's made in chemical plants. But the bugs that grow out, these are generally bugs, bacteria that come from the gut. And so for whatever reason, there's contamination of this. So I don't know if it's from fertilizer, from the harvesting or whatnot, but particularly one E. coli and then some things related to E. coli have toxins in them that can cause things like renal failure or a bloody diarrhea, and that can be life-threatening. It's all goes back to, even with these kits that say they're pre-washed or they wash 3 times, it says when I buy my spinach at the store, I think it's still good to wash that. The way I do it, and I'm not sure if this is right or wrong, but I soak it in water for about 20 minutes and then rinse that thoroughly. So I drain the water, rinse it thoroughly, and usually it's best to cut open the salad so you expose the root. So cut it crosswise so you go like kind of dissect the root so you can really get inside the leaves of the deeper part of the lettuce and really wash that thoroughly. I think if you don't know where the romaine is sourced, it depends how much you trust your grocery store. I tend to be, if you haven't picked up on this yet, I'm skeptical and some would say cynical. It might be so wise to stay away from romaine lettuce. There's lots of other leafy products out there that are probably good for us too. So
here's something else you can be cynical about. A cereal company wants to remind us that one of its classics is heart healthy.
Time to reach for my trusty Cheerios.
For the first time in 40 years, General Mills is adding heart shapes to Cheerios, the original yellow box version and honey nut. USA Today says the limited edition boxes will be on store shelves into February, which is Heart Health Month. A company spokesperson says it's about reminding breakfast eaters who don't read cereal boxes. And despite reports millennials are killing the cereal industry, General Mills insists consumption is on the rise, with baby boomers leading the way. Deborah Rodriguez, CBS News.
What's your breakfast advice for us? Do you like whole grains?
A balanced diet is always great if you haven't picked that up yet either. So, I think whole grains are part of that. I keep on talking about eggs. I think eggs are probably okay sometimes out of the week. If it's every day, I'm not sure that's exactly ideal. I think a balanced diet with that includes some fruit or sometimes I'll make scrambled eggs with some peppers mixed in, and my wife is really good at making those. So I think a variety is a good thing, and there's lots of things out there. There's Cheerios, there's Honey Nut Cheerios. To me, the difference is Cheerios seem to be pretty tasty. I like to eat those myself. Honey Nut are coated with sugar, so I'm not really sure how heart healthy they are. It sounds like a very good marketing plan, though.
We're talking with Dr. Fred Buchholz. He's a SLU care general internist at SSM Health, St. Louis University Hospital. One more story I wanted to talk to you about. It's a new report on the best type of exercise maybe for older women.
Older women should hop to it. British scientists say hopping for 5 minutes a day could protect older women from broken hips. The hopping can strengthen the bones in the legs, making them more dense and less likely to break. Older women often suffer from brittle bones brought on by osteoporosis. Weight-bearing exercises appear to keep bones strong in older people, and hopping can take the place of lifting weights or running. Jim Shenevy, CBS News.
Have you heard of that before, Dr. Buchholz?
I haven't heard of the hopping, but I'm buying in. They're absolutely right. Load-bearing exercises are really, really important for bone health, particularly for women after they go through menopause and they have less estrogen, and that kind of contributes to bone decline and bone degeneration. So weight-bearing exercises are excellent to build up strength of the bone itself. And remember, most people break their hip by falling, and falling almost always, very often, I should say, it's caused by kind of issues with balance or being off balance. So hopping, kind of works on the stabilizing muscles around the hip and really can strengthen that. And that's something that goes away very quickly as we age gracefully. So I think it's a fine exercise. I mean, correlated to that might be jump rope too. For a short time, probably has some positive impact.
I remember in a conversation with you earlier, you talked about how important it was to work on our core muscles.
Yeah, so exactly. So, core muscles are really the muscles in our back and our stomach that kind of keep and really maintain our posture. And these are things that just good posture and fundamental kind of alignment of our bones really prevents and keeps us from being injured in a lot of ways. So osteoarthritis of the knees or the hips. Often a result of us, sitting for too long. I see a lot of patients. I was talking to my residents this week about you see a lot of shoulder injuries from people not doing anything to their shoulders, but we sit and drive all day, or we work at a computer all day, and it pulls our shoulders forward, and it just kind of keeps our muscles out of alignment. And we don't work well, or we don't work enough of our muscles in our back between our shoulder blades to kind of keep that posture in the right way. And again, I've been to physical therapy 3 or 4 times for this very thing. So I'm aware I don't practice what I preach, but it's really, really important. I myself have been trying to work on this more and more.
Dr. Buchholz, always fun to talk to you. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Fred. Thank you.
Dr. Fred Buchholz is a SLU care general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Coming up next, we'll find out why some people are skipping their needed heart medications. You're listening to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Now, back to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. A new study finds U.S. heart patients cut back on life-saving drugs due to the cost of their medication. According to this study, one in eight adults with heart disease delays filling prescriptions, taking less of the medication than prescribed, or skips medications altogether because of high out-of-pocket costs. Here to talk with us about that is Dr. Aaron Tang. Dr. Tang is a cardiologist with the SSM Health Medical Group in St. Charles County. Dr. Tang, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you very much for letting me speak to you about this.
So what's going on here, Dr. Tang?
Well, I think with the rising costs of medications, it's become a decision between whether patients can afford to, you know, take their medications that will help with their pressing medical concerns, or doing things like paying for groceries or paying their bills. And I think that in some cases, patients find that if they skip a medication dose or two, they don't feel the immediate effects of their cardiac ailments. And so in the short term, it seems like a good idea. But I think I'm here to talk about how over the long run that may cause increasing costs and further detriment to their medical health.
Yeah, tell us about that, Dr. Tang. How important is it to take your heart medication as prescribed?
Well, some medications are more important than others to be taken on a very strict schedule. But obviously, our recommendation is that all the medications that we prescribe should be taken when we give you the certain schedule. And the reason being is that the medications, depending on the mechanism of action, work over a course of time. And, you derive the greatest benefit from taking it at the prescribed schedule. When you miss doses, you don't derive that benefit anymore, and that can lead to things where you start to eventually develop symptoms, or you need to be hospitalized. And again, those types of things not only impact your health, but will eventually impact you financially in the long run.
Have you seen patients do that in the past?
Yes. Unfortunately, increasingly, we've seen a lot of patients come in with increase in their symptoms. And when you talk to them and get a more detailed history, you find that they have been missing medications because of things like costs different life choices that have led to them choosing their medications not being a priority. Obviously, from our standpoint, we place the patient's health in great priority. So we try to emphasize the importance of taking these medications, or if there are alternative medications that would be just, almost as effective, but less costly, we go down that route. So, in the heart failure realm, most of the medications we prescribe are low cost. They've been around for a long time, and a lot of them are generic. So we typically try to stay within those, recommended medications. But there are some new medications that have come out that are particularly effective in reducing hospital admissions for heart failure. The problem that I find, though, is that they are expensive medications. And a lot of patients, when they go to fill their first prescription, get a little bit sticker shock. And, it's something that I try to let them know that there may be an issue or maybe a high price when you go pick it up. And I try to describe the benefits that are associated with it. But in the end, it comes down to a patient decision on whether or not they think that they can afford that medication or not.
Have you had patients ask you about alternative therapies as opposed to medication?
So if you're talking about alternative therapies, as in different medications in the same class to use, that's something that I think is reasonable to discuss if their particular formulary has a same class medication, just a lower price. I'm willing to discuss that and figure if that would work. If we're talking about alternative medications, as in holistic or just a different non-pill-based medications, it's difficult for me to make comments on that because I just don't know the research associated with benefits in those alternative therapies. So, and I've experienced both, asking about getting alternatives in both those modalities. So that's how I approach that situation.
How important is it, Dr. Tang, for a patient to work with their doctor as part of a team?
Yeah, I think that depending on your comfort level with your patient, they should be hopefully at ease talking to you about whatever situation strategies they're using to go about being as healthy as possible. I've found that a lot of my patients who I've had for a while are comfortable talking to me about any of their alternative strategies they take, and I try to give them my best advice with whatever knowledge I have regarding that alternative therapy. If I don't have knowledge on it, I will, readily state that, and then most of the times I go back and read up on alternative strategies. But again, I think that it's best if patients feel comfortable enough, if they feel comfortable, discussing all of their medical needs with their physicians.
We're talking with Dr. Aaron Tang. He's a cardiologist with SSM Health Medical Group in St. Charles County about a new study that suggests U.S. heart patients are cutting back on some life-saving drugs due to cost. Dr. Tang, does this affect people differently based on their age or gender?
I don't think that there are specific studies that show, or at least I'm not aware of specific studies that show that it affects particular age or gender. I did see that it seems that a lot of the younger patients have been less adherent to their this has affected young patients at a greater number due to a lack of insurance, whereas many older patients are covered under Medicare. So they have, they have that coverage, and they're more likely to be adherent. But I don't know if it affects particularly due to their age. I think it has mostly to do with the ability to be covered under insurance.
What happens if you just inadvertently miss a dose of your heart medication?
Again, it depends on which types of medications. There are for instance, I was talking about heart failure earlier, missing a dose of that of a medication may result in an increase in symptoms later in that day or maybe the next day. But there are some medications that we prescribe to our patients, particularly in cardiology, that have to do with, they're called antiplatelet medications. And that an example would be aspirin. Another example would be Plavix, which a lot of our patients are on. And they take these medications after they receive a stent to treat coronary artery disease. Those medications are essential to be taken with recently placed stents because it can affect the patency or the effect if the stent actually works or not. So those medications are ones that we highly encourage people to take every day, regardless of whatever situation is impeding it, because the consequences of a stent suddenly closing are very significant and almost always result in having to be seen in the hospital, admitted for multiple days, and potentially having to have more stents placed. So the consequences of stopping medications are wide-ranging, and these are things that should be discussed, with your physician. With my patients, I try to make sure I emphasize which medications are essential to continue taking, and, obviously if you're running low or if there's any financial barriers to being able to obtain that medication, we work our hardest to make sure that we overcome those barriers so that the patients are able to get the medications they need.
Dr. Tang, is there anything a patient can do to help them come off heart disease medication altogether?
Well, there are some studies that show that working on lifestyle changes such as reducing your BMI or reducing your total weight can help to lower blood pressure. So if you were able to lower your overall blood pressure, that might help in reducing the amount of blood pressure medications you're on. I suggest this with all my patients, and I talk to them about lifestyle modifications they can do to help with their overall health. But I think that's the easiest and the least costly way to reduce the amount of medications that you're on for your cardiac medications.
Dr. Tang, thanks a lot. Anything else you want to add?
No, I think that I guess the last thing I would add would be that if there are any situations where you're thinking about making a decision between your medications and your other financial responsibilities you have, it's best to discuss that situation with your physician. Your physician and their staff will work tirelessly to make it so you're able to overcome those financial barriers. to make sure you get the medication you need, or at least get an alternative medication that will be of benefit to you. Try not to do this alone, and let your physician be your advocate.
Dr. Tang, thanks a lot for your time.
Of course. Thank you so much, Fred.
Dr. Aaron Tang is a cardiologist with the SSM Health Medical Group in St. Charles County. Coming up, we'll find out why so many children seem to be having serious knee injuries these days. You're listening to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Now, back to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. Serious knee injuries are on the rise in kids and teens. To find out why, we're joined by Katie Smith. Katie is the Outreach Manager for SSM Health Cardinal Glenn in Sports Care. Katie, thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here.
So are you seeing an increase in kids coming in with knee injuries?
So we are, and I think the biggest thing is not only is it an increase, but it's an increase in the number of young kids that we're seeing come in with a lot of these injuries. Typically, injuries like ACL injuries we wouldn't really see until middle school or even really high school age. Nowadays, we're starting to see this happen younger and younger, and even under the age of 12, which is historically not something we used to see years ago with these types of injuries.
Why do you think there's that increase?
So one of the things that we've really looked at from a research perspective is the types of activity that kids are doing at a younger age. And the change in things like club sports and year-round sports has really changed significantly in the youth population. And having kids specialize in sports specifically at a young age, at even an age like 8 or 9 years old, we really think that's had a major effect on their bodies and that it's led to these more of adult or high school, middle-aged injuries that we used to see really happening in these younger population because our bodies just aren't really prepared to handle this type of stress over and over, especially when they're specializing in that one activity for, 8 to 12 months out of the year.
So year-round sports could be a concern as well?
It is. And so, we've come out with a lot of new recommendations on really for the youth athlete, what is safe and what's the best chance for them to not have these overuse injuries and for really them to be more successful. And one of them is to just delay specialization for as long as possible. So to wait to more like middle school or high school to do that sport specialization and really only be participating in one sport. We really would prefer that kids do organized activity, but switch it from season to season. So, hypothetically have a child in the fall playing something like soccer, then in the winter playing basketball, and then maybe in the spring softball or baseball, because that really changes the amount of stress that's on their body and changes the stressors. So soccer is a lower extremity sport, basketball is a lower and an upper extremity sport, and baseball or softball is more of an upper extremity sport. And so that stressors are different, and it really allows their bodies to change and adapt with that change in season, with the change in sport. And what we've seen is that their chance of success is significantly higher when they do that change of activity throughout that year.
So cross-training is important.
It is. It's important to really just change up what they're doing and then really give them the opportunity for rest. So we still recommend that in between those seasons they have time of rest and that really the number of hours that they're participating per week in an organized activity should really match their age. So hypothetically, if a child's 8 years old, they really shouldn't be doing more than 8 hours of organized activity per week. And by matching that, it's a really good rule of thumb to make sure that we're not overtraining these kids, both from a physical component and a burnout component. They can be doing physical activity outside of that, but it shouldn't be within an organized sport. So they can be playing outside or playing in the backyard or riding their bike. But if they're going to be in these organized sports or activities, they really need to be limiting that to the age that they are and then increase as their age goes up.
You mentioned ACLs were pretty popular injuries. What else?
The other big thing that we see now that we never used to see in really the youth population is things like UCL injuries. So that Tommy John surgery that we hear about specifically in like professional baseball, we're seeing that in 11 and 12 year olds now. And 10 years ago, that was not something you would ever see. That was something that you maybe saw in high school, potentially saw in college, definitely saw at the professional level. And now we're seeing this at the youth population. population. We're seeing at the middle school, very commonly at the high school. And really that has a lot to do with how much these kids are throwing year-round baseball, and having all that stress on their elbow at that young age can really have long-term repercussions. And we may not see it initially, but unfortunately, after that repetitive stress happens, their chance of having a UCL-type injury goes up dramatically. And unfortunately, it's not even the initial injury, it's the long-term effect of that. So you look at UCLs and ACL injuries, the long-term complications, things like arthritis or the chance of re-injuring those ligaments when they get older or into middle age. And so there are definitely some long-term repercussions as well as those short-term repercussions that can happen from doing so much of that specialized training.
Are there any recommendations to avoid the UCL injuries from pitching?
So it's the same specialization guidelines that we use that we talked about earlier. But additionally, the other big thing is to really make sure that they're getting 2 days of rest per week, because really having that time to shut down, especially something like throwing, really makes a big difference in their arm's ability to recover properly. Unfortunately, when a lot of kids specialize early, they're training 6 to 7 days a week, and they don't get that recovery time to be able to really recover from the throwing and all the physical activity that they've done, which makes them fatigue. And fatigue is one of the biggest precursors to injury. So when we get those 2 days of rest, we get the recovery aspect in play. And then that really decreases the fatigue that we end up seeing in that day seven or day one of the following week. And that really can increase our chance of success both on the mound or doing other activities.
Or they're playing for two different teams at the same time.
So that can definitely be detrimental as well. I think we still need to keep the same recommendations in mind. If they're playing for two teams, they really still need to be having those 2 days off. They shouldn't be doing more than hours per week matching their age. So, you know, a 12-year-old should only be doing 12 hours of organized activity. So if they can meet those guidelines and play for two teams, that's okay. But most teams, the requirements are higher and higher. So we really just need to limit the amount of activity that they're doing and then change that activity. So even if they're playing for two teams, my preference would be that they're playing two different sports then and not the same sport if they're playing on two different teams, because that way the stressors are a little bit different on the body from sport to sport instead of just that constant same repetitive trauma. The chance of injury just is dramatically higher when they do things like that.
We are talking with Katie Smith. She's the outreach manager for SSM Health Cardinal Glenn in sports care about sports injuries in kids and teens, specifically serious knee injuries that we're hearing a lot of, especially in younger children these days. Katie, how do you know when to take your child to the doctor?
So I think from a kid perspective, the biggest thing is that kids should not have a change in what we call activities of daily living. So if something is bothering them and not allowing them to just do their day-to-day activities, so going to school, sitting down on their desk, walking to their classroom, playing outside, when an injury or a pain is changing that, they really need to see someone. And not only do they need to see someone, but especially these kids that are so physically active really need to see a pediatric sports medicine specialist, because kids are not just tiny adults and they have to be treated very differently. And because these are injuries that we typically would see in the older population, we have to treat them very differently than we would a 16 or 17-year-old or even older with these types of injuries. An ACL injury and a patient that's done growing is very, very different than a patient who still has, you know, 5 to 10 years of growing left in them. So they really need to see an appropriate specialist who can evaluate what's going on and then make recommendations that are appropriate based on the level of activity that they're doing, but also their age, because that varies significantly. And that's a mistake that unfortunately a lot of parents make, is they see a specialist, but unfortunately it's not the appropriate specialist based on the child's age. At Cardinal Glenn, we're very fortunate to have a great group of pediatric sports medicine specialists, and we offer a 24/7 triage line that is available for parents to call or text at any time. If they have a question or they're not sure if their child should be treated, they can give us a call or text us, and we can walk them through when it's appropriate for their child to be managed. And then additionally, we can make those appointments for them. And so when parents have that question, they can always give us a call or give us a text message at 314-577-5640. And we can really walk them through what the next steps are to make sure that their child's in the best hands and make sure they get the care they deserve.
Are there gender differences when it comes to these type of injuries?
So some injuries injuries there are. ACL is probably the biggest one that we talk about with that. Females are more than double as likely to have an ACL injury as a male. Much of that has to do with the angle that our hips and knees are as females, and so that's what we call a Q angle. So females are always more predisposed to an ACL injury, and their level of recurrence is typically higher as well. So that's a very common injury that we would see in the female population.
So, Katie, what's your basic message here for parents?
I think it's just very important to remember that kids doing physical activity is a great thing and something we want to encourage, but we want to leave them open and able to do lots of different types of activities and not pigeonhole them to doing one activity all year long at that young age. The more we can broaden their ability to do lots of different activity, the more chance we have of not having them burn out, but also making them really physically active and better chance of success as they reach high school and adulthood after that.
And remind us of the numbers people need to know just in case they want to get in touch with you.
Absolutely. You can call or text us 24/7 at 314-577-5640.
Good deal. Katie, thanks a lot for your time. Really appreciate it.
You bet.
Katie Smith is the outreach manager for SSM Health, Cardinal Glenn, and Sports Care. Coming up next, we'll find out more about the hair dye and breast cancer study that's got everyone talking. You're listening to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Now, back to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. A new study links hair dye and chemical straighteners to breast cancer. How worried should we be about these new findings? Let's ask Dr. Stephanie Schnepp. Dr. Schnepp is a breast surgeon at SSM Health St. Mary's Hospital. Dr. Schnepp, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you.
So tell us, Dr. Schnepp, what does this new study find?
It's actually hard with some of these to prove that there's any like actual cause and effect between these two things. So what they're looking at is really just they're looking at comparing characteristics among people who have developed breast cancer and who haven't, and different things that might vary about whatever their exposures are, lifestyle habits, and things like that. And so then they find sort of what they call associations. So it's hard to say for sure that a certain thing causes a certain thing to happen, but you can kind of link up, well, what do these things have in common? So, you know, if this group of people seems to be getting cancer at a higher rate, is there something else in common with something that they've been exposed to? And that's what they found in some of these studies about some of these products, is that, you know, some people who use these products, especially more frequently, and are exposed to those products more, might have a higher risk of cancer than other people who do not use those products. You know, and I think some of the things that, you know, would be suggested is certainly for people who work around these products, who may be hairstylists and you know, have to be exposed to these products, that they're, you know, doing things to maybe protect their skin and not have a direct, you know, touching of the product, wearing gloves or things like that. Or even if people are applying these products at home, that they may do things like that to try to sort of minimize some of their exposure. Might not be a bad idea, just in case.
In this study, participants who used chemical straighteners every 5 to 8 weeks had a 31% higher associated breast cancer risk than women who did not use chemical straighteners as frequently. There's a difference, though, when it comes to African-American women and white women in this study, isn't there?
Yes. And, you know, why that would be, I'm not sure. You know, depending on which there's a higher rate of certain types of breast cancer amongst African-American women as well. Whether, you know, that's not really laid out in this study, how that affects the different subtypes or things like that. But there was a difference shown in that study, and why that would be is a little bit unclear.
We're talking with Dr. Stephanie Schnepp. She's a breast surgeon at SSM Health St. Mary's Hospital about this new study that links hair dye and chemical straighteners to breast cancer. Dr. Schnepp, in general, though, what would be the best advice you would give women for how to lower their breast cancer risk?
That is a difficult question that really varies from person to person, depending on, you know, different individual risk factors. It's still very unclear on, you know, there's no one specific thing that we have linked to a cause for breast cancer. There are some people who have no risk factors for breast cancer who develop it. There are other people who have many risk factors for breast cancer and do not develop it. So it's probably multiple factors that go into, you know, why a person may or may not develop breast cancer. So it's somewhat difficult to pinpoint exactly what can be done to minimize risk. So we're still, you know, there are some things just, you know, of course, generally leading a healthy lifestyle, trying to, eat as minimally processed foods as possible, trying to expose ourselves to as little environmental exposure to different possible cancer-causing things. But again, this just becomes difficult in our modern world to eliminate any exposure to anything that you know, could be cancer-causing. So I think that those things are difficult. We're kind of left with just really trying to increase detection and screening in some cases, you know, trying to, when cancer does develop, trying our best to find it as quickly as possible, and then continuing to improve our treatments. We're just not quite at a point where we could, you know, eliminate the risk for breast cancer as much as we would like to try to figure that out. We haven't quite figured that out yet, but that's what studies like this continue to try to move forward and try to find, you know, are there certain things we can pinpoint that we could avoid or to try to avoid this.
What are the major risk factors for breast cancer?
Well, there's, in some cases, it could be a family history that people do have a history of something, you know, genetic or hereditary in their family. But that actually accounts for a smaller percentage of breast cancer than probably most people think. So really anyone, even someone who does not have a known family history of breast cancer, can certainly develop breast cancer. So, throughout life, as we go along, things will change in our body. And with time, certain amount of people can develop things that grow as they're not supposed to. And that's how the process of cancer develops. There can be certain things that we, you know, look at when we have these risk calculators of who is at risk for breast cancer. And some of those things are, history in the family. Some of those things are people who have other types of borderline things on biopsies that might lead to a future risk for breast cancer that might predict that. Women who have never had any children will tend to have a little bit higher risk of breast cancer, or who have their first child over age 30. Those are small impact on things. There are some things that, you know, are suggested that might decrease risk, such as breastfeeding is something that might lower risk a little bit. These are all, again, little impact, small things that. But when we calculate who is at more risk than others, those are things that are taken into account.
What about some of those lifestyle issues like weight and physical activity and alcohol use?
Yes, actually, yes, that's something that we do counsel our patients on that are possibly at a little bit higher risk, is maintaining a healthy weight something that can decrease risk for breast cancer, or even after people have a history of cancer, it can possibly decrease risk for recurrence of cancer. And even there are some studies showing that even if people lose like 10% of their excess weight, they can reduce risk. So it doesn't necessarily have to be that people are completely at their, you know, ideal weight or goal weight, but if they're making some moves towards a more normal, healthy weight range, that can improve or decrease risk for cancers. Exercise, even separate from weight loss, even if people don't lose weight, regular exercise has been shown to decrease risk for, and this is not just, these are not just exclusive for breast cancer, this is multiple types of cancers. Other types of cancers as well have decreased risk from people who regularly get exercise, even if they don't lose weight necessarily. So all of those things are kind of independently associated. Some people, some studies show that eating a lower animal fat diet, not a lot of animal products, more plant-based diets, there's a lot of research into that, decreasing risk for breast cancer. Not necessarily that they have to completely eliminate all meats or animal products, but making that a more smaller part of the diet than the standard American diet, and more of a increasing the plant-based products that people take in. And again, staying away from, those more processed food products that weren't even on our food supply 50 years ago, we just don't really know the effects of so many things we're exposed to now. So all of those things definitely go into it. Alcohol use specifically, yes, there's a lot looking into that, and that is important because, the social use of alcohol has increased over the years, actually, especially among women. I think women are drinking alcoholic drinks at higher rates now than they may have been, 100 years ago or so. And so there is some evidence that as little as, one or two drinks a day may increase risk for breast cancer. So, if people are having a couple of glasses of wine every night, that actually can be increasing risk of breast cancer. And I've even seen some separate studies of specifically of younger women around college age, if they are, either drinking daily or even on the weekends, having, several drinks at a time on a weekend, that what they're doing, even in their early 20s, can be impacting their future risk of breast cancer. And so there's actually some campaigns to get out to college campuses and try to reach these younger women and say, you're not worried about breast cancer now, maybe, but what you're exposing yourself to now actually can be kind of impacting your future health. And, in the future, you may be increasing your risk of breast cancer. So there's a lot still to be learned about all of this, but all of those things, can play a role in damaging the processes in our body that can eventually lead to these unhealthy cells that can turn into cancer cells.
Dr. Schnepp, thanks a lot for your time. Appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.
Dr. Stephanie Schnepp is a breast surgeon at SSM Health St. Mary's Hospital. And that's all the time we have for this week's show. Thanks so much for listening. I really do appreciate it. If you want to hear parts of this show again, please log on to KMOX.com and look under the podcast section. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. Please join us again next week at the same time for another edition of Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.